Kia ora, g'day and welcome to the History of Aotearoa New Zealand. Episode 90, Spates, Like a Zip. This podcast is supported by our amazing patrons. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. Last time, we went over the first major gains made by the Prohibition movement in their effort to rid at least parts of the country from alcohol, and how the brewing industry responded to them. We also talked about some big changes at Spates, from getting new equipment and staff to becoming an LLC. Today, we will continue to see the Prohibitionists gain more ground, and see how the outbreak of World War I affected the brewery, both of which led to a key decision that changed the course of Kiwi brewing. But first, let's talk money. Something you may find a bit interesting is what the workers at the brewery were earning in comparison to their bosses. Around this time, Spates shares were paying out a dividend of 30%, giving Greenslade and Dawson an annual income of about £7,500 each, potentially more than $1 million in today money. Which of course doesn't include any of their other business interests or their salary. The salary could have been around £2,500, or about $500,000 today, which is what one director was earning a couple of decades later in 1929. We also know the figures of what other workers earned that year too, such as the head brewer got £1,500, $165,000, and Hugh Adam, as secretary, accountant and director, got £1,296, $142,000. Brewers, travellers and clerks tended to be on the upper tiers of payment, between £240 and £480, that is $26,000 and $52,000. Apprentice brewers were earning much less than that, Charles Greenslade's grandchildren earning around £96, or $10,000. To compare this to the workers who were doing the hard graft, such as coopers, cellarmen, carpenters, maltsters, cask washers, and the foreman for each of those areas, they made about a shilling an hour. Let's assume they got paid for 45 hours a week, which excludes unpaid hours they quite possibly worked. That comes to about £117 a year, or $21,500. And that's a generous estimate. Others have it closer to being £100, or $18,000. That salary number of the average worker comes from 1907, but we have the numbers for what these workers were being paid in 1929 as well, and it's roughly the same. Which means, over two decades, these workers didn't get a pay rise, and with how inflation works, that means they got a pay cut. For reference, all these numbers are annual salary. Something else to keep in mind is that these guys were doing a lot more manual and back-breaking labour than their bosses were, and earning a shitload less money. To say that the founders were earning off the backs of their workers would be an understatement. In any case, with his large amount of wealth, Dawson now invested in another major business, a jeweller which had an optician attached to it. George Chance was the optician, and he was also a well-known photographer, pushing the jewellery/optician firm to also move into photography supplies as well. At the same time, Spates acquired a pretty significant asset, a whole entire second brewery. It was on the corner of Pitt and Elder Streets, up the road from the current bog, and although it isn't there today, apparently the remains of the water well is still within the flat at number 18 Pitt Street. The brewery was called Strawn's Victoria Brewery, and was put up for sale by the National Bank. However, initially Spates didn't want it, Hugh Adam saying it wouldn't result in any extra sales. The bank was quite persistent though, with their final offer coming to £10,000, which again was rejected. This probably would have been the end of the matter if Greenslade hadn't been approached by someone when he was in Christchurch. This random person told him that a syndicate of Spates's rivals were planning to buy Strawn's and would, quote, dispose of as many shares as possible among the free houses, end quote. The free houses are pubs and hotels not owned by a particular brewery. So, the idea was that the syndicate would buy the shares and just hand them out among the unaffiliated pubs, tying them to Strawn's and meaning they would likely only purchase beer from that brewery and stop buying all others. This is partly guesswork from me, but what is clear is that this very much alarmed Greenslade, because he immediately approved for Spates to purchase the brewery. The one condition he had was to keep the acquisition private and not let anyone else know, possibly because he thought that a newspaper headline that said Spates buys out competition would be fuel for the prohibitionists. Unlike his counterparts who were off doing their own thing, Charles Spate was pretty consistently hard at work as a brewer, despite being a company director. As well as his normal duties in the top job, he also took it upon himself to come in on nights and Sundays to check the malt floors, temperatures of the fermenters, and all that kind of stuff. Additionally, he was very active outside of work. Like his father James, Charles was in the volunteer forces, which led him to be on the committee that was to raise and equip two contingents that would be sent to South Africa to fight in the Boer War. After the war, he was also helping organise the men that came back from South Africa to return to civilian life. Naturally, Charles was involved in other businesses too, having an interest in the same electric company as Greenslade. As well as being invited onto the boards of several other companies, he was a founder of the Dunedin Manufacturers Association, a member of the Chamber of Commerce and the Freemasons, and was also involved in sports and charities. All of this put a big strain on his health, so on his doctor's orders, he went on a holiday around the Pacific Islands and Australia in 1910, the only occasion he left New Zealand. At this time, he also bought a holiday home in Broad Bay on the Otago Peninsula, which was the place to be if you were a rich Dunedinite, especially if you liked sailing, which Charles did. He was a keen yachtsman with a 14-metre yacht, which he had the workers clean and polish when it was raced. The house was pretty big, with a tennis court and a horse paddock, which had a horse in it named Ginger. Named so for Charles's own nickname, as he was also ginger-haired. The only way to the bay was by ferry, and the managing director of the company that operated the ferry was Charles Spate, who also owned 25% of its shares. Though the shares never paid out, as he only did it to keep the ferry service running, as it was vital for the residents that lived there all year round. He also took up rifle shooting as a sport after World War I, creating his own club. Looming again in 1911 was election season, meaning the prohibitionists were back, and they were gaining even more ground. Up until now, there was no real threat of the entire country going dry all at once. The chances of every single electorate getting past the 60% threshold was really unlikely. However, since the last election, the movement had convinced Parliament to make a couple of changes to the law. The first was that the drinking age had been raised from 18 to 21, which was a simple but effective change in removing a whole group of people from being able to purchase alcohol, at least legally. Another simple change was that the time pubs had to shut their doors for the night had been pushed back, first to 11 p.m. in 1893, and then again to 10 p.m. in 1910. These new rules were all fairly minor, at least in comparison to what the government changed on the referendums that coincided with the national election. As I just mentioned, so far it wasn't terribly likely that the entire country would go dry after one election. The 60% threshold for prohibition was just too high for all 76 electorates to hit all in the same year. However, When voters went to the polls in 1911, there wasn't just boxes for reduced licenses or local prohibition. They could now tick whether they wanted the whole country to become dry. All at once. No takebacks, no redos. New Zealand would have no alcohol sold within its borders. There was a catch, though. Over 60% of voters had to go for it before it would be put through, same as local prohibition. This was a monumental victory for the temperance movement. For the foreseeable future, this would be the guillotine over the head of the industry. The worst part was that the industry would now need to fight for their jobs every 3 years, almost like politicians did. With such a huge amount at stake for both sides, things were tense right up until the final count. In 1911, the Wowsers gave it their best go. I'm talking pamphlets, prayer circles, protests, letters, sermons, you fucking name it, they did it. And in the end, they got 55.8% of the vote. Obviously, this wasn't a total victory for the prohibition movement. They failed to get the 60% needed. However, they were only 4% away. And that was enough to give them some hope that the fight wasn't over. Taking this back to Spates, what did they have to say about the whole situation? Well, with sales still growing, Spates had been fairly confident that national prohibition wasn't going to happen. They were so confident, in fact, that they decided to commission even more development on the Rattray Street property. In 1911, in classic fashion, a well was dug and connected to one of the older wells. At the same time, some more land was purchased that had a blacksmith and a carpenter, leasing them to tenants for the time being. The next year, Strawn's, now owned by Spates, was moved to the site of the Red Lion Brewery, which had also been bought by Spates. You can start to see here the gradual domination that the Pride of the South was getting over the Dunedin beer industry. Being the largest brewery in the country, they were well placed to secure their hold on the Lower South Island. The next year, in 1912, the Shamrock Hotel that had stood on the corner of Rattray and McLagan Street next to the brewery since before it was founded was demolished and a four-story fermentation house was erected. This building still stands today and contains the Spates Ale House restaurant on the bottom floor. At the time, the building was called the Shamrock Building, but in future I'm going to refer to it as the Spates Ale House for simplicity. The upper floors held a bunch of equipment, but the basement was rented to a brass band for a while as their practice room, and was known as the band room, even after the lease ended. While the building was being completed, the 50 hogshead brewing plant that had yet to be upgraded was replaced with a 100 hogshead plant, bringing the total to 200 hogsheads that Spates could output per brew. That translates to about 48,000 litres of beer, and remember, they were brewing about 3 times a week. Capping it all off, they acquired a bit more land, the cask washing courtyard was moved, and a changing room for staff was added. Up until this point, Spates had an entirely male staff, except for Mary Jane Spate, who was an employee both in the sense that she had shares in the company after her husband's death, and since she cleaned the offices part-time. The brewery's first full-time female worker was Nora McGee, who started working at Spates in October 1913. She was employed as a typist and shorthand writer for £2 a week, which is about $350 or so. As with a lot of employees at Spates, she got in partly due to familial connections, hers being that her father was a traveller for the company. Funnily enough, not only was she the first woman on staff, she was also the first typist. Up until this point, all letters, documents, etc. were written longhand. In 1914, sales were booming, with shares increasing their dividend payout to 40%. So, you could say, things were going pretty damn well, despite all the prohibitionist stuff. Spanx was being sold in many different places across the Pacific, from various islands to Australia and all over New Zealand, except for North Auckland and Rotorua. Every region had up to approximately 40 outlets that sold Spanx, the most being in Wellington, which had 39, the next most being Taranaki with 34. Interestingly, Auckland only had 6, which I suspect may be because a lot of major breweries were based there, so competition would have been high. Spanx was even so popular that one writer said that Kiwi drinkers were in two camps. Quote, those who drank Spanx and those who didn't. End quote. That same year, Charles Keast pulled out of the bottling partnership with Powley, his share being bought by Greenslade and given to his son Bob for his 40th birthday. This prompted a name change from Powley and Keast to R. Powley and Co. Some new labels were made to reflect this, though the logo was, by and large, still the same, with the characteristic moor on the front. The contract was also possibly renegotiated somewhat, so that Powley's bottling contract for the Middle and South Islands were for the next 99 years. We've spent all this time talking about Spanx the people, Spanx the company, Spanx the brand, Spanx the brewery, but what you might be wondering is what did Spanx the beer taste like back then? Of course, the Spanx sold in modern pubs is different to that of the late 19th and early 20th century, since technology, regulations, and science in general has progressed over the last 100 years. Unfortunately, the variety of hops that were used back then are no longer grown, so we aren't able to make the Spanx that Dawson, Greenslade, and James would have brewed. But we do have a description of what it tasted like. Quote, its alcoholic strength was considerable. At first, I did not like it. It was too bitter for my young, untried palate. When I made a grimace, the barmaid smiled and told me I should have made it a shandy. So next time I called for a glass of Spanx, I asked for a lemonade with it. Only too soon, however, I grew to hate the sweetish, destroying aspect of lemonade, and always called for a Spanx straight. There was something stern and solid about Spanx in those days, but oh, it was a lovely beer. It was 3D. No one who had drunk old-time Spanx can ever forget it. I know of New Zealand exiles, now in Australia and further abroad, who still think of the land of their birth in one word only. Spanx. End quote. I'm not sure how much of that was true, given the clear nostalgic tone, but it does provide some useful insight, namely that Spanx was very bitter at the time. Something that Spanx was quite well known for, other than their beer, was their tug-of-war team, of which Dawson was the captain. This team won a number of events, including the championship at the Otago Anniversary Sports in March 1914, which came with a £20 prize. They again won at the Garden Fete a month later, and according to the ODT, garnered, quote, much excitement, end quote. This was some good fun and a bit of brightness in the lives of those in attendance. Many of those men watching would soon be leaving Aotearoa's shores, never to return, as New Zealand went into one of its first true tests as an independent nation. The outbreak of the Great War, or World War I, resulted in a number of changes in legislation for breweries, mostly ones that hindered them but helped the war effort. In 1915, the duty on beer was increased, meaning that breweries would need to pay more to the government to export their beer. In response, most of the brewing industry decided to lower the alcohol percentage in their product, as the duty tax was linked to this. So, less alcohol in a beer, less tax to be paid. It was none other than Charles Spate, who had considerable reputation and standing in the industry, who convinced other brewers to reverse their decision. In Charles's own words, quote, this matter was fully discussed at a meeting of brewers held in Wellington last month. It was the intention for the brewers to reduce the weight as much as possible with a view of saving the duty. But I pointed out to them that if they did, it would probably mean a further increase in duty at the next session of Parliament. After a good deal of discussion had taken place, it was decided that the whole of the brewers, representing the Brewing Association, would agree to continue brewing as at present, with a view to endeavouring to keep up the duty for the current year to the amount as stated by Sir Joseph Ward. End quote. Joseph Ward was the leader of the Liberal Party, and at this time was the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister in a coalition government with William Massey's Reform Party. Basically, it would be like National's current leader, Chris Luxon, accepting to be the Deputy PM and Finance Minister in a cross-government coalition under the Labour Party, headed by Jacinda Ardern. It was something that was done in response to the war, and apparently was not very smooth sailing, because Ward and Massey didn't like each other that much. But we don't have time to get into that here. Point is, Charles managed to convince the brewers not to lower the alcohol in their beer. Because, ultimately, the government were just going to make them pay it anyway, however they managed to do it. Because the whole point was to raise money for the war effort. Charles apparently did this speech despite the fact that he wasn't a very good public speaker, tending to mumble to the point where it was hard to understand him. So this shows that either he really pulled out a ripper of a speech, or the respect the brewers had for him was so immense that they were swayed in spite of his lack of rhetoric skill. An impressive feat either way. In 1917, what would become one of the biggest influences on the culture of Kiwi drinking was introduced. The 6 o'clock swill. This came off the back of nearly 160,000 people signing petitions to call for the 6 o'clock closing of pubs, as being drunk was seen as being unproductive to your work, and if you were unproductive, you weren't helping or even could be harming the war effort. Thus, a reduction in hours that pubs could operate would give people, mostly men, less time to drink and more time to be patriotic, essentially. Pubs put up surprisingly little resistance, hoping that an earlier closing time would take the wind out of the prohibitionist sails and stop them from pushing for an outright ban. This didn't quite eventuate, as we will see. For Spates, it was the barley growers that they were concerned about. Many considered switching to other crops to make up the loss that would occur from the downstream effect of reduced sales of beer. Every year, Charles Spate and his maltster, Charlie Beasley, toured the quote-unquote barley districts to inspect the crop, and 1917 was no different, but it came with that added challenge. Upon hearing this concern, probably numerous times from different farmers, they decided to buy the whole harvest up front. In exchange, the farmers would exclusively supply barley to Spates in future, and the brewery would be contractually obliged to purchase. Naturally, many farmers took them up on this offer, but not all the barley was up to the standard required for brewing, so it was instead sold as chicken feed. This was obviously not ideal, but then again, the whole situation wasn't ideal, and getting quality barley wasn't exactly the point of the venture. It was to give the farmers a cash injection now, while also giving them confidence and stability knowing that Spates would buy their product in future. For Spates, this meant that less farmers would switch over to other crops and thus ensure the supply of one of their main ingredients. Interestingly, another response by Spates to the 6 o'clock closing was planning a non-alcoholic beer, possibly with the idea that it would be sold in places that beer ordinarily couldn't. Powley registered the label, but it doesn't seem like there was any further progress than that. We do find that later in the 60s that Spates made a quote-unquote near beer called Tom Thumb, which was made by taking a tiny amount of beer, adding hops, sugar, wort, caramel, and heaps of water before then carbonating the whole thing. The taste was, well, I'll let Spates' archivist tell you himself. Quote, one had to be extremely thirsty to enjoy it. End quote. That is a big oof. Once the swill ended in 1967, Tom Thumb soon followed, since it was no longer needed. With the war on, the logistical and supply chain side of things was naturally being strained, meaning there was a shortage of imported goods, such as new casks and oak needed for the coopers. These deficiencies in their supply, along with the national restrictions on shipping, meant that Spates weren't able to send product to quite a few of the previous international market, mostly Australia and the Pacific Islands. As was to be expected, sales dropped, the first time since the Depression of 1883, 34 years earlier. The needed oak did eventually make its way across the world from Russia, but it was soon discovered that some of the wood had bullet holes in them from the recent unrest in the country. That being the Russian Revolution. Just because there was a war on didn't stop expansions at the brewery though. In 1916, an even deeper 50-metre well was bored into the ground, gaining access to an even larger source of water than before. Above the borehole, a pump known as Clanking Annie was set up to pump water from the well to the reservoir connected to the other two sources. This provided the brewery all the water it needed, so some of the older wells were sealed. In late 1917, on the 19th of October, Charles Greenslade was in his office, waiting to be picked up to go to the Caledonian Bowling Club. He was to inspect preparations for the opening season, something that he was very fond of. Unfortunately, he never made it, having collapsed in his office and died from an unknown cause. He was 74. As you might expect, his stake in the brewery was passed on to his son, Bob, who also filled his now vacant seat on the board. Charles Spate took Greenslade's position as managing director, since he was basically doing that job already, and Dawson took Charles's board chairman seat, since he couldn't do both of those jobs at the same time. It sounds like Greenslade's death hit Dawson particularly hard, as he started devoting more and more time to working for the brewery, more so than he had done for many years. He also stopped his overseas trips, though he was forced to start doing them again after he had a health scare in 1922. He arrived most mornings in a chauffeur-driven car, and his daily routine started with the same instruction, sent via telephone to the upstairs office. Quote, "Bring up the bank books," end quote. If there wasn't anything else that needed doing, he would invite a mate round to have a whiskey with him before heading off to Dawson's Limited, the jeweller-slash-optometrist-slash-photographer. Over the course of the war, the Prohibition referendums had been suspended, since that cost money and that was needed for the war effort. In 1918, the government agreed to hold a special referendum the next year just for Prohibition, not attaching it to any general election. After this, the referendums would repeat with each election as they had done before the war. The government weren't just willing to go back to the status quo, though. They were willing to go a little step further. They dropped the voter threshold from 60% to 50%. This was fantastic news for the temperance movement, and they gave it just as good of a go as they had done in 1911. And they came extremely close. For a little while, it looked like they had done it. They were going to win. But 40,000 special votes from soldiers who were still overseas or on ships returning home took a little longer to be counted, and their votes were almost entirely anti-prohibition. As such, at the final tally, prohibition was defeated 51% to 49%. If those numbers astonish you, just you wait. That isn't even the closest they would come. Another referendum was to be held at the end of 1919 to coincide with the regular national election. This was also the first year where a third option was added to the regular wet or dry: state purchase and control. Basically, that the liquor industry would be owned and controlled by the government. This wasn't a very popular option, so we're not really going to talk about it again. This referendum, the one at the 1919 general election, is as close as New Zealand has ever come to fully banning alcohol. The Wowsers getting 49.7% of the vote. This result was a pretty clear sign to the brewing industry in Aotearoa that to secure their future, they would need to make some bold choices. As such, it would have been around this time that a radical idea was put forward to ensure the breweries across the nation would survive, with Charles Speight being a major player in those discussions. These talks were kept fairly secret for quite a while, and the results wouldn't be seen for some time. With the future of Speight's and the brewing industry in general looking a bit bleak, no major developments were made on the Speight's site in the late 1910s in an effort to save money. What they did invest a bit of money in, though, was transport, specifically motor vehicles. By 1919, early cars and trucks were starting to replace horse-drawn carts as the main method of getting around town and delivering goods, including for casks of beer. Near the end of the year, a garage was built on the McLagan Street side of the brewery, but despite this, Spates's first company car was pretty average in size and not used all that often. Very few people in the brewery were allowed to drive it, one of them being traveller Alf Brown, who was only allowed to use it for out-of-town places, like Outram, since it didn't have any public transport. Typically, the travellers would make their rounds to each pub on foot, trying to sell Spates's beer to them and ensure that their current customers were looked after. During these visits, it was customary to shout everyone currently in the pub a round or two, which they did at every establishment they visited. Brown had a bit of a problem, though, when some rather enterprising folks found an exploit. After figuring out Brown's schedule, which I assume was the same and fairly regular, they would go to the first pub and get around for free on the Spates company wallet. After downing this pint as fast as they could, they would head outside to where they had parked a bunch of bicycles and ride off. Brown would then finish up his business and head to his next stop, where he would find the same group of chaps waiting for him to shout the patrons another round. And so it went. The cyclists would bar hop just in front of Brown all afternoon to get sloshed entirely for free. This apparently caused a bit of tension between Brown and Adam, when the former came back asking the accountant for more money to do his rounds, which Adam was rather unwilling to give. Around this time is also when Spates's most iconic piece of branding appeared, the 3 8-pointed gold stars which started appearing on Powley bottles. It was thought that these were meant to represent the triple star, as mentioned in the national anthem. Another thought is that they represent the 3 X's in the triple X beer. However, the story I was told when I went to the Spates Brewery was that they represented the first 3 gold medals that Spates won early in their brewing career, playing off the other part of the logo which had always been on the labels prior to this, calling their beer Gold Medal Ale, which is still the name of their most recognisable beer to this day. By 1920, 2 years after World War I had ended, and after many years of lacklustre sales, Kiwis began buying more beer again, and the brewery needed more space to handle casks, so some more land was bought to expand the operation. Even so, international shipping still hadn't recovered to its pre-war levels, which was a bit of a problem for Spates. But thankfully, a solution was found in collaboration with some other Otago manufacturers. One of these manufacturers was Richard Hudson, a wealthy baker who sold biscuits and chocolate, eventually merging with Cadbury's, possibly leading to what would be the famous Cadbury factory in Dunedin. The other was John Shacklock, who made hobs, ranges, and other kitchen equipment. The plan was to approach the head of the Union Steamship Company, New Zealand's largest shipping company at the time, to see if they could work out a deal to ensure their products made their way to other markets. Despite the fact that the three men, plus others they spoke for who were not present, represented a large portion of Otago's manufacturing, the union company were pretty harsh on them, telling them to either make do with what they were already offering, or just don't bother. This took the blokes by surprise, as they were pretty positive going into the meeting and rather deflated upon leaving. In the end, they decided to take the union company's offer. If the current service wasn't good enough, they would do without, and make their own shipping company, with blackjack and hookers. Well, obviously not the hookers or blackjack, but they did make their own shipping company, called the Dunedin Whanganui Shipping Company, in 1921, with their ship, the Holmesdale, making regular trips up and down the eastern side of the country. Of course, all the manufacturers took shares in the new company, including Spate's, with Charles Spate taking some for himself. The Holmesdale carried a supply of Spate's weekly across the country, and quickly became known as the Mercy Ship. It would keep doing this until 1956, where it would be sold to another company in Japan, and renamed the Pacific Maru. Not all Spate's was shipped on the Holmesdale, though. Some was shipped via the Christchurch Shipping Company too. In 1923, everything changed for Spate's, and indeed the entirety of the New Zealand brewing industry. Those discussions that were being had at the end of the 1919 election were starting to come to a head, with a proposal being put forward by the owners of the Lion Brewery in Auckland. A merger between the largest breweries in the country. They posited this idea to have a number of advantages, chief among them being the ability to make a centralised propaganda campaign to fight the prohibitionists. Amalgamation would also have the effect of removing some of the aspects of the industry that the prohibitionists pointed to when making their arguments. Such as, upon merging, they would release shares for purchase to the general public, which would mean that it could no longer be said that a select few quote-unquote beer barons were the only ones profiting off New Zealand's drinking. Additionally, merging the largest breweries would see less competition for tied houses, pubs that were owned by one brewery and only sold that brewery's beer. If all the breweries were essentially the same company, then a pub tied to one of them would have access to all the company's breweries. Naturally, this was put forth as being a good thing for customers, and indeed it was, since they would get a wider selection of drinks from their local. What's interesting is that this merger may not have even happened if the prohibition movement had pumped the brakes. But they didn't. The referendum at the 1922 election showed that prohibitionists were still going strong. They were losing steam, but very, very slowly. This was a positive result for Spate's and other brewers in one sense, but in the other, it showed that there were still a fair number of people that would prefer for their business to not exist at all. Spurred on by these results, and likely other indications from the prohibition movement, the merger went from just talk to a reality. Brewers from Auckland, Wellington, Gisborne, Christchurch, and McGavin's from Dunedin all signed on. But it wouldn't mean much if New Zealand's largest brewery, who probably made as much beer on their own as the others combined, didn't join up. However, things weren't so simple in the Spate's camp. Charles Spate, having been involved in the early talks, was naturally pro-merger. But Bob Greenslade, now having his late father's shares, was against it. Dawson likely didn't care either way, as he was suffering from breathing and heart issues, as well as possible depression from the recent death of his wife. So he wasn't much involved with this. It's important to note that this wasn't a merger in the sense that the three directors would retain full control, or even near full control, of Spates. It would require a sell-up of the land, buildings, equipment, and everything else. They would get to keep their shares, and we will come to see they did retain their directorships, but it would come at the cost of no longer having total autonomy in high-level decision-making, including whether the brewery would shut down. This was Bob Greenslade's chief sticking point, saying, quote, "They're not going to sell my bloody birthright," end quote. To me, it seems like Bob's opinion was as much about the emotional aspect, possibly tied to his late founding father, as it was to the business aspect of Spates. Despite this staunch opposition, he was put under intense pressure to agree from Charles, probably saying that if the brewery went at it alone, he wouldn't have a birthright left. Bob then announced he consented to the merger, but only if the prices offered for their shares was increased substantially, the rumour being he wanted £100,000 more. The motion was put forth on the 18th of May 1923, and the final decision made just over a week later at Dawson's home, the last original founder shakily signing his name. With that, Spates was no longer an independent brewery, but rather one of several run by the parent company, New Zealand Breweries Limited, who I'm gonna call NZB from now on. The official handover taking place on the 1st of July, 1923. If you're weird like me and interested in the numbers on how much NZB paid for Spates, well, we actually do know that. It was just under £370,000 in total, which included £75,000 for the land and buildings, £68,000 for the machinery and other equipment, and £31,000 for the beer already brewed and sitting on site. An additional £194,000 was also added for goodwill. Strawn's wasn't included in that sum, since it was a subsidiary of Spates, but it sold for £38,000, bringing the total to just over £400,000 paid, about $46 million in today's money. Taking stock, at the time of the merger, Spates's production was higher than ever before. 70,000 hogsheads a year with about 150 staff, including 30 cellarmen, 29 maltsters, 24 coopers, 18 cask washers, 18 office staff, 16 carters, 5 coppermen, 5 engineers, and 4 carpenters. One of these was Alex MacDonald, a cooper and former All Black captain. He was based in Wellington, being the Spates representative there, and part of his job was to inspect the casks as they arrived off the boat. He found, on more than one occasion, that they had been tampered with. Thirsty sailors, having taken the white hoops off, drilled a hole in to extract the beer inside, and then replaced the hoop to cover the hole, and the evidence of their misdeeds. As mentioned, Charles and Bob became directors of NZB, along with an additional 6 others, Dawson not being among them. As the leaders of the largest brewery in the merger, they were expected to attend monthly meetings in Wellington, but Greenslade never did for as long as Charles was alive, possibly harbouring some resentment towards him for the whole situation. In total, there were 3 breweries in Dunedin that were part of NZB. Spates, McGavin's, and Strawn's, and a local board was set up to manage them specifically. Both Charles and Bob were named to the board, the former being the chairman. Also on the board were Hugh Adam, who we know well, and John Einge, the managing director of McGavin's. Less than a month after the merger went into effect, tragedy struck again. On the 27th of July, 1923, in Wellington, after a few months of declining health, William Dawson died. He was 71. He was a rather important man in the Otago area, having been a councillor, mayor, member of parliament, philanthropist, and businessman. In fact, his wealth was so large it resulted in nearly £100,000 in death duties, which is a tax of 40% of all assets at death. In more modern terms, that's just over $11 million in tax. Part of this was that he left behind 9 houses and a number of thriving business interests, including Spates. Additionally, 2 archways from one of his properties was bought by the city council and placed at the corner entrances of the Botanic Gardens, where they still remain. July 1923 was a month of incredible change for Spates. And I wouldn't be surprised if Charles, Bob, Hugh, and others at the brewery felt that this was the end of an era. The last founder of the brewery had passed away, one of his last acts being to relinquish control not to a family member like the other 2 founders, but to a larger collective. Well, I say all that, but by and large, Spates continued on as it always had. They were still shipping via Dunedin Whanganui Shipping Co., which they still owned. Beer was still being sold all over New Zealand and exported across the world. And, perhaps critically, the beer was still called Spates on the bottle, even if the brewery itself was technically known as the Dunedin branch of New Zealand Breweries Limited. 1923 was the year that everything changed for Spates and New Zealand brewing. And in many ways, nothing had changed at all. Immediately after the merger, though, Spates effectively went dormant. No new bold moves were made, no new buildings constructed, and no new land purchased. Whether this is because everyone was just getting used to the new situation, or whether there were some other factors, such as finances, we don't know. Whatever the case, it would be a couple of years before the beast of southern brewing awoke from its slumber. Next time, we will see Spates go into some of its darkest times as the Golden Age comes to an end. Between the deaths of key figures in the company, a Second World War, and a disaster, things start to go downhill rather quickly. If you want to send me feedback, ask a question, suggest a topic, or just have a chinwag, you can find my email and social media on historyaotearoa.com. Aotearoa spelt AOTEAROA. You can also find helpful resources there, like transcripts, sources, and translations for some of the Te Reo Māori we have used. You can help support Hans through Patreon, buying merch, or giving us a review. It means a lot and helps spread the story of Aotearoa New Zealand. As always, haere tū atu, hoki tū mai. See you next time.